Hello there, bakeroos and bakerettes. Welcome to the Rise Up podcast. I'm your host, Mark Dick, and this is the show about bakers and bakeries and bakery owners and all the folks that work so hard, often through the night, to make the good stuff and share it with people in their communities. How are you this week? What a week, eh? Holy. I've been watching old Saturday Night Live clips on YouTube, like the really old ones from the 70s, you know, like the first season. And Gilda has this catchphrase when she plays Roseanne, Rosanna Dana. She goes, "It's always something." And I've been saying that a lot this week. It's always something. My goodness. I hope you're okay. I hope you're staying safe and staying healthy and baking lots. You know, I'm good. I'm doing just fine. I started 2021 with a bit of a work regimen, with some extra habits. And it's working so far. Okay, like it's 7 days in. But I'm back on a schedule. I'm back working with timers. For me, I'm not baking anymore. I'm sitting down and I'm writing, but I get my butt in the chair on time, set a timer, and get to work. No internet, no distractions, just sit down and write. And it works. You know, I find that I do better when I have a set routine. You know, it was hard to get up early at the start, but when I had the bakery, at least I knew I was getting a set routine. You know, I'd come in the morning and I'd check the starters and I'd mix the rye and I'd mix the sourdough and I'd make a coffee at 5 a.m. and I made sure I got every last little flax seed out of the mixer before I mixed baguettes at about 6 a.m, you know, like that kind of thing. Oh, hey, I never even mentioned today on the show. It's Noah Elbers from Orchard Hill Breadworks in New Hampshire. I am super excited about this talk because Noah has been a real inspiration to me and a huge help right from the first days of getting started in baking. And I'm just thrilled to have him on the show. Yeah, so that's going to happen for sure. You know how this works. I talk for a bit and then we have a conversation. And my talking was about habits. And about routines and about timers. And I got a timer running right now because this is my section where I record the intro to the podcast. And I'm not going to stop and do something else, like play with the cat. But I was talking about routines at the bakery, right? And how you can get into a rhythm and you can get into a daily routine. And it's a beautiful thing when that happens. You know, and this writing and podcasting and coaching life that I've got now, It's got its rewards as well, right? Like I get to talk to y'all and I love that part. But being left to my own devices, that causes a few problems, like lots and lots of procrastination, right? Like sometimes days and weeks of procrastination and distraction and deflection and a fair bit of overeating too. It's not a good thing that I'm this close to the refrigerator, I think, and all the delicious food that's in there. But so I'm back to living with timers. You know, I sit down, I put the laptop on airplane mode, and I write until the timer goes off. And then I walk around the apartment a bit and I avoid the kitchen and sit down and do it again. And, you know, the second round might be editing audio or sending a podcast invite or connecting with folks in Bakers for Bakers. But it's, you know, butt in chair time, set the timer, get to work. And it works for me. You know, I find that I'm even starting earlier and earlier in the day too. You know, like not baker hours, not by a long shot. But just like when I had the bakery, I hate doing, you know, heavy lifting in my brain in the afternoons. So I try and get at it in the morning. You know, make a coffee, light a candle, get the keyboard going and a timer, and get to work. You know, and it's, like I say, it's working. So I'm curious about your routines. Like, what do you do to keep you on track? Do you have any kind of neat tricks and habits or tips or little hacks? Are you a timer person or are you just a feel person? I've worked with some bakers that just, I don't use timers. I just kind of, you know in my bones when stuff needs doing, which I find insane, but you know, teach their own. I don't find it insane. I find that those folks are working at a higher level, which I have not even glimpsed, you know, not even a glimpse. I need a timer to at least say, go check and feel how everything is doing. But if I don't have a timer going, it might be 7 hours later and I realize, hey, what's that tub of dough doing over there? That kind of thing. But anyhow, okay, this is the part of the show where, you know, the transition to the talk, right? Where if it were any other podcast, I'd put an ad in here, right? Like something for website hosting or home security or stamps or magazines or some such, you know, usually something with easy monthly payments. But instead of that, I want to plug our show supporters. I want to give a shout out to the folks that have made voluntary subscriptions to the Rise Up podcast. You know, they support the show every month with a small donation that when you add it all up, it covers the cost of putting the show together. So thank you to the dozens of bakers who support the show with either a one-time or recurring donations. You know, folks like John and Michael and Newt and longtime monthly supporters like Judith and Lori and Chloe, who have been supporting the show ever since I put the little button on the website, you know, and brand new supporters from just last month, like Venny and Zane. Thank you so much. Every little bit adds up and it gives me a boost and it keeps me inspired to keep making these shows and keep bringing bakers together. So you can do this too, dear listener. You can be a supporter too. You just head over to riseuppod.com and click the support the show button and you'll get set up. It's quick and it's easy and it's painless. And like I said, every little bit helps. It all adds up to something way bigger than the little pieces, and it fills me with joy. So thank you very much, everyone. Seriously, I appreciate it. Head over to riseuppod.com if you want to do this yourself. All right, Noah Elbers. Like I said, this chat was a real big deal for me since I've known Noah since the old days, since before the guild even. Like Noah was around in the Brick Oven chat forum when I was first researching ovens back in 2004 or even before that. And when I joined the guild, whoop, there he was again, you know, helping me out from a distance. And he's still going strong. Noah, he's still going strong at the bakery on the farm that is Orchard Hill Breadworks. You know, he's making the good stuff. He's also building a legacy and he's really looking at how his business can go beyond, have a bigger impact, put it that way. And we talk about all of that stuff. And so I'm really excited to share this with you and let's get going. Noah Elbers, Orchard Hill Breadworks in Allstead, New Hampshire. Good to finally talk to you.
I know. Gosh. Yeah. This is, I'm excited for this.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about this, you know, kind of all week, kind of sort of not, well, prepping for the call, I guess, but I can't think of a time where I didn't know you, even though we've never talked to each other before. because like you were on the old Brick Oven list back in the day too, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One of time on the Brick Oven list as well.
Yeah. Cause I think that's where I met you even before the guild and that kind of thing. Cause you have, or you had an Alan Scott oven, right?
I had an Alan Scott oven. Yeah. For 5 or 6 years. And definitely got into, baking through that sort of community, that avenue.
Yeah. Yeah. But I was on your website and you've got, to me anyways, the fancy Spanish oven now and have had for quite some time, but,
right. Yeah. It is now that I, look back, 2007 feels like, ages and a lifetime ago. Plus,
2007 was when you switched over.
That's when we brought Spanish oven. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. See, cause I did a workshop with Alan in 2004. And built my oven in 2006, and then would have been right after that. Then I guess that you switched over. And are you still doing like wood fire baking? Is that still the way that Orchard Hill works?
Absolutely, very much.
Wow, mm-hmm. good for you. That's That's cool to me that you've been doing it for quite some time that way. What's your thoughts now? Are you still kind of happy with that as the way of doing it?
I think there's a great segue into this conversation. Yeah. Actually. So what Orchard Hill has become in the last, well, really since the beginning, it's been a teaching bakery. But of course, when I was starting and I had apprentices arriving, I won't say I was as secretive about it, but I didn't know much. Okay. And so we were learning together in the early years.
Right.
And since that time, now that it has many, many years have passed and I'm a couple decades into the journey of sort of gaining skills and knowledge about business and baking, I would say now the bakery is a legitimate teaching, a place of learning.
So cool.
And we have an apprenticeship program that we host 3 full-time residential year-round apprentices. How it's structured, we could get into more of the details of that. But at the heart of the way I see it, I certainly don't assign any of the kind of romantic, mythological almost elements of how, you know, a wood-fired oven you know, makes the best bread because it's a wood-fired oven.
Right.
But what I feel strongly about and I see in now after having the opportunity to work with dozens of apprentices is that and with staff through the kind of conversations and the process that evolves from working with the wood-fired oven is my long-held belief that tools which we invest in a multifaceted relationship with are tools that we end up both learning a lot more about ourselves and learning a lot more about the process with which we are engaging. And so a wood-fired oven, you know, managed well and tended in a thoughtful, pragmatic, efficient way, demands a lot of the user.
Right.
And I just believe that the process of learning that and then having the experience of that, put simply, it just makes work a lot more engaging and interesting. It makes it frustrating sometimes. It isn't as efficient maybe as a tool which we, you know, which is more of the kind of modern state-of-the-art features that so many tools now have. And I'm no Luddite. I'm not like, you know, we have to use the most primitive tool to make good bread.
Right.
But I feel really strongly that, that given the opportunity to, work with things like, you know, that are simple and, but also demand of us a kind of commitment to the learning process and a commitment to, understanding the variables that go into making it perform well, just results in a daily work or a week of work when you look back. And I find that I just think about it as like, oh, wow, what I learned so many things this week from, you know, my relationship with a tool that I, you know, spent this time engaged with, you know, interacting with.
Right.
And I think because that's something that's exciting for me and it just gives me a sense of kind of greater purpose in being an employer and being a teacher, it naturally is carried over to my teaching relationships and my co-working relationships, in that, you know, I'm excited to share what I've learned, or what I, you know, stories about, you know, missteps that I have taken, or, you know, kind of the big breakthrough moments. And those, you know, they tend to happen, they happen more with tools that have the possibility of both ends of that spectrum happening, where you're right. Like, wow, I really blew it this time, didn't I? You know, I overfired the oven, and I had to, you know, unload the entire thing in, you know, in less time than I had, you know, ever unloaded it before. And I had to basically restart the whole process, and, you know, and then this, that sort of end of the spectrum exists. And then because of that experience, you also have the sort of epiphany moment where it's like, oh, wow, you know, like I made these adjustments to how I was working and, you know, learned these things. And then it felt incredible to turn out, you know, an entire bake where I felt really good about every loaf that came out.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it's like, for me, at least I think of, you know, say some of the new technology and whatever ovens or whatever it happens to be, right? But there's so darn many variables that it's almost, and so many dials that you can turn or settings that you can set or that kind of a thing that, you know, I'm thinking even like my phone, for crying out loud, that you'll never really understand how any of it works, right? But with, you know, with simpler tools, or maybe, you know, or I don't know, simpler is not the right word, but it's like there aren't that many dials on an oven, right? You know, you've got a lot of variables, but they're kind of under your control, and you're trying to understand the bigger picture of what's going on. And when you get those insights, it's sort of like, whoa, there's some, I just got some deep knowledge here, you know? and it's like, 'cause like, there's all kinds of variability of these, like something like a brick oven, but it's, but you know, but not a lot of settings, if that makes, you know, well, sure. That kind of makes sense, right? There's a difference there.
So, I've had, at this, by like probably hundreds, probably not thousands, but definitely many hundreds of, you know, school groups come through,
sure.
or children come through in school groups, and just various opportunities to share, about the oven. And I pretty much describe exactly what you just said as, there's no black box.
Yeah.
There's no part of this. Like basically, most of the tools that we're using are like 19th century technology, where you just look at it and all of the ways that it functions are describable, and they don't rely on anything that's just, you know, that you have to use your imagination to figure out. Like you
right.
can look at a gear, you can look at a firebox, you can look at the counterweighted door that just opens and closes because you push on it, you know, and then the counterweight closes the door. And that is a specific example when I own this iPhone, and you know, it's not,
yeah, yeah.
not like I'm no Luddite, but I often will share the counterweighted door as now, you know, 13 years into owning this oven, that door has operated exactly as it was designed hundreds and hundreds of thousands of times.
Right.
Without an error. Without a like system error or crash yep. or anything like that.
Yeah.
And obviously what it performs is pretty simple, but it also performs a beautifully elegant and 100% necessary job in the bakery of like easily opening and or allowing the baker to effortlessly deposit things into the oven and then close without the baker doing anything.
Yep.
Like, wow, yep. that is truly something that, you know, that we don't celebrate enough. Those things that like, they just do their job. And the fact that somebody, you know, probably somebody at least 100, probably more than 100 years ago, kind of designed that technology and tinkered with it to the point where now we do take it completely for granted when it happens.
Yep.
But I'm sure whoever designed it had that moment of like, this is going to, you know, this is going to change. Right. And some of these old ovens, you see like all different kinds of methods of counterweights and, you know, a slide up or a slide down. And I mean, they're all kind of neat, but like this door in particular is like, I think probably the simplest, and there's no spring. There's no, you know, there's no crank, there's no pulley. It's really just pure and simple counterweight.
Yeah. But then the feel of it feeling exactly the same way every single time is amazing. Like one of the introduction threads on Bakers for Bakers is I have a goofy little quiz, and I ask about sort of like, what's your favorite tool at the bakery? Just trying to capture that exact same thing, right? Like the thing that always comes to mind for me is my bench scraper, like my bench knife, right? And it's sort of like the one that I use every single day. Just there's a feeling there, and if I pick up a different one, it doesn't feel the same. Or you have a couple different models, and that there was, I had one at my bakery that, you know, wasn't mine. Like, I wouldn't let anyone else use it, but it was mine that if I'm going to be using something, that's the one I want to use. And nobody else liked it. You know, it was sort of like it was too tall and too narrow, or, you know, too whatever for their perfect bench knife, but mine was exactly perfect, you know? And yeah, there's just something satisfying about those extensions of you when you're working. You know, I it's gotta be why, well, you guys can geek out about any kind of analog thing, you know, in whatever strikes their passion. I know musicians that have the same discussion about certain brands of guitars and stuff, but yeah, very cool. So yeah, so you are on, like, Orchard Hill is a farm and was a farm before it became a bakery, right? Like, how did this become the place where you were going to be?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I would say there's two parallel storylines.
Sure.
That I'll share. One being the kind of who and where, and what would appear on the family tree, sort of, right?
Right.
So that is that my dad has four brothers. He and a couple of his brothers, when my dad was 17, and a couple of his older brothers, were very much a part of the kind of back to the land movement, and came up to New Hampshire to work on a farm that was started by a company in Boston called the Air One Company, which actually is still around. But this farm was the idea was that it would supply a lot of the like organic vegetables, and dry beans and things for this small company in Boston.
Right.
And so a whole, you know, piece of property was purchased, and my dad and several other folks came up, and they really, they just loved the area. And the farming was, of course, super tough because New Hampshire is rocky, shallow soils and hilly fields.
Yeah.
And, it wasn't prime agricultural land. That was why the farms were so cheap. but my dad decided to stay, and he and his brothers convinced my grandparents to actually purchase a close by property. And that's where Orchard Hill is. So while the farm that they originally moved to existed as a business for only a few years, this property that my grandparents purchased stayed in the family. And my dad and my grandfather planted apple trees and a couple of small plots. And my dad has managed the orchard here for over 40 years.
Okay.
It's about 5 acres of fruit trees.
Wow.
And, you know, in that time, we've had various small scale agricultural endeavors that have, come and flourished for periods of time. I actually started after high school. I kind of thought I was more excited about growing things, and I kind of did a small market Market Garden for a couple of years. And it was during that time that I figured out or had was inspired to build an oven and start baking. But at the onset, it was very much a hobby. And it was also the idea was to sort of augment the work that my dad was doing in the orchard. So
right.
I had the concept of like making pies and during the harvest and maybe baking some loaves of bread for the customers that we had coming to pick up apples or pick up some cider.
Right.
And so that, you know, that was the starting point. I would say that's the storyline of like the who and the where. The parallel storyline probably goes more to, or definitely goes more to like what was in my thoughts. And I was far from conceptualizing the idea of a business or the impulse to, you know, be an entrepreneur or a teacher or any of the things that sort of have happened since. But when I think about like what I was really starting to chew on at the time, it was the ideas that I have in writing and the work I did sort of as a senior in high school was a lot around the idea of like what do we do while we're here on earth that matters,
right?
What does work really represent? And I guess to me at the time, I started to kind of wrestle with the ideas of what constitutes a successful person.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think, I mean, of course, being an idealistic teenager and, or, you know, young adult, I focused a lot on how messed up everything was and how it sort of distorted our view of, you know, of sort of reverence for celebrity and reverence for consumerism and accumulation of wealth being everything that this culture reveres, which, I mean, not that I've changed my mind that much that it's that those things are folly. But I, of course, have some of my idealism was definitely tempered by the realities of, you know, becoming an adult and supporting.
Sure. Oh yeah. Yeah. But it's that white hot, pure feeling when you're young though, it's like, there's nothing like it.
Yeah. And so, right. Exactly. I think, you know, and like I said, I had no real, I wasn't setting about being, you know, forging my own way and doing it differently, sort of like I've never really had a strong like activist streak in me, but if I look back at what this journey of being a business owner and an entrepreneur has largely been about, it is and has become very much, I think, a model of trying my best to balance the more traditional ideas of success around like growth and financial stability and sort of monetary exchange, balance those with service and inclusion and the sorts of things that my ideals would lead, you know, or do lead me to, which are kind of the removal of as much of the transactional monetary obsession as possible in business and in kind of our relationships. So how that is expressed is 100,000 different ways, I would say, but you know, the mission of the bakery has largely become to be a place where we're exploring the I don't want to, alternative is such a charged up word right now, but where we explore the ways in which like a business can thrive and be a successful both financial, but also central and integrated part of a community.
Yeah.
And that is through so many different forms of value exchange. They're not simply the transaction of, you know, offering a loaf of bread for sale, and then getting the money and paying my employees. Like, while that of course happens and it has to happen, to me, what feels like most exciting and gets me up every day is more the, like, the ways that while that's also happening, other, maybe I'm going to say more rewarding, because more rewarding for me, and I don't discount that, like, so it's fine for people to have, like, a, you know, the drive to have, like, fair wages and all of those things. They're important to me too. But what's more exciting to me is, like, how do people get to do their work in the world and feel actually fulfilled by it, not just because of their paycheck?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly. Like, the I'm revved up just hearing you say that, because I work with a lot of folks in different businesses, like non-baking businesses, and a lot of folks that are kind of out on their own as well. And it's just this idea of fulfillment and sort of how can that thing that you're building, that business that you're building, you know, really give you fulfillment across a wider spectrum than, you know, it's how I get paid, you know, and line up with, you know, you're talking about a trans or exchange of value, and it's really also lining up with your values, whatever those are. Right. And, you know, the values such as, you know, like equity and inclusion and that kind of thing. But also, you know, you've got an entire life, sort of built on, you know, making a living from this land or on this piece of land, you know, that kind of a thing too. Right. And that's, that can be important as well. That's that sense of place.
Absolutely. And I guess, yeah, hearing you say that, another, how I've gotten into, how I got into baking, and then the ways that the bakery has succeeded, on all of these fronts, I don't want to skim over or pass by just how many benefits I have received, both in incredible mentorship from dozens of either business owners, other bakers who knew a lot more than me, bakery business, you know, bakery owners, who, you know, who shared in incredibly generously of themselves, and really maybe for more intensely this year than any year before, a real examination of looking at the kinds of privilege that me as a white, landowning, English-speaking male has, that makes, while I am, like, proud of what I've done and hopeful that I will look back on like those things as having contributed some value to the world, there probably has never been a moment on earth where anybody is more put in a position of having those things that I've succeeded at be possible than the spot that I found myself in. And I don't take that for granted.
Absolutely. It's I'm still unpacking. Well, and I always will be. I think just sort of just the advantages that how I was born and where I was born has, you know, the privileges that I've gotten. It's like, Yeah. You know, there's been struggles in my life and stuff, but boy, oh boy, you know, everything was set up to help me out the whole time through. And that's not true for everyone, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, right. I look back at some of those early years of like what it took to keep the bakery going, and the kind of, often I just think of it as stubbornness, was probably the, you know, the chief attribute that I, was born with, of like just having an endurance for what at the time felt like just the unending, you know, stream of not setbacks, but just like, oh, like I'm still working 70 hours a week just to whatever, you know, like, and I don't, you know, they sound paradoxical to both say, I know looking at who I was born, you know, to, and how I arrived at that spot where I could even be having that business and having that choice to say, I want to do this job that's going to require 70 or 80 hours a week. It sounds paradoxical to say that that's a place of privilege, and also say, yeah, that was extremely hard. And like, the number of times I thought, gosh, I just really wish I had a job like a UPS driver who I could just, I'm sorry if there's any UPS drivers listening.
No,
the idea of just like showing up and driving around and taking packages out, like, was really appealing a lot of the time. Of like working full overnight and all, you know, and all that stuff.
But it's true. You work so darn hard, and there's this, well, for me anyways, there is this idea of like, you know, I'm building a thing. I'm building my own thing, or later our own thing, you know, however it is. And then there are days where you just want someone to tell you what to do today. and fire me a check at the end of the day. Like, I was describing it to a friend. I had a big challenge with the project I'm working on just in the last week. And I said, it seems like I'm not in a dip, but I turned the corner and I just got a glimpse of the road ahead, and it's a heck of a lot longer than I thought it was going to be. And then you get those realizations when you're building something, and it's like, oh, okay, it doesn't matter what's behind you. I got a long way still to go. And that can be overwhelming at times. Right. And that's, you know, like, cause you've been doing this for, you know, quite a while. And it's like, and you get those moments all the time. It's just the way of the beast.
Yeah. And I would say, about that, what I hope someday I won't have to as actively remind myself of this, but I still very much do have to actively remind myself of this, is that we're pre-wired to, you know, instinctually look for the end point being the goal, right? You're going to arrive, and this idea, like somebody's going to string a medal around your neck or something. And of course, that's so, it's a sure way to feel both disappointed and also, you know, and hopeless, because we're in a process that has no ending. Like, I mean, lots of people, I think their pure inspiration is to start a business. Like, they're, you know, the entrepreneur who starts the business and sees that it's flourishing and then passes it on. I mean, that I guess is in a way like the closest model to the, like, somebody, you know, putting a medal around your neck.
Yeah.
But I know for myself, what I, and this is the thing I remind myself of, is like, the object of the game is, to, you know, find those things that you haven't yet figured out.
Yeah.
And if you are just even the slightest bit curious, you will find many dozen things every single day that you haven't figured out. And then when those things start to make a little bit more sense, lo and behold, they're going to reveal a whole bunch of other things. And many of them are not the traditional, like, I mean, I love the work of designing and kind of, you know, digging down and designing and refining systems and just watching them work. Like, it feels very satisfying to me. But I think most of the things that are like the real work that we do are not really the tangible things. They're the moments when we are kind of confronted by our smallest selves as business owners, as you know, as friends or as coworkers, and do something other than our habitual pre-patterned kind of reaction. Yeah. And well, that takes a lifetime to work on, because it just is, it's different every single time every single interaction where you have reverted to the habitual response, whether it be dismissiveness or, you know, and I think I wouldn't be this far into business owning if I were a horrible boss or, you know,
right,
whatever. But like, I know that there are still so many ways that I fall short of what I would like to, you know, I am not the ways that I would like to be. And I'm not going to, you know, beat myself up over it every day or feel, you know, disheartened. But I very much see that the real work of like finding a sense of success is like showing up every day to and accepting that that process doesn't stop. It doesn't, you don't like finish and get to the end, you know, the
yeah,
cross the line and be like, yay, maybe you design a really great system and it works wonderfully and everybody, you know, feels, you know, satisfied with their work in it. Although that hasn't happened either, of course, because it's that's almost as flawed of a thinking. But there are so many ways that I think the sort of tangible world and the more traditional expressions of, you know, how we classify these success stories are they're often held up in front of the other work that happens in a much more quiet way.
Yeah.
But then actually the quiet work is really the humbling and also most fulfilling.
Yeah. I'm curious when we've talked a little bit about the apprenticeships that you do at the bakery, and I'm curious when did that start? Or I'm curious about what they are and sort of how it works, but I'm also curious about when did that start? Was that sort of an original thing that you've been doing right from the start, or did that sort of come later?
At first the bakery, you know, I was very much a solo act with the help of my, you know, a couple of friends and my parents. Right. And then within a couple of years, I had the first person who came along, asking to, work beside me to learn to bake.
Right.
And like I said at the beginning, like my baking knowledge was, just ever so slightly greater than anybody walking off the street.
Right.
In the measure of like how much I've learned since, I would say I had, you know, taken my first couple of really small baby steps towards understanding what was actually going on and being able to teach about it. So in that sense, yes, there's been an element of the bakery being a teaching space all along. As the decades, and by about 15 years into the bakery's journey, I started to some kind of, there was a bit of a model in place where I would have an apprentice come in the spring and spend the summer months here, and then sometime in October, a few times it was like I had long-term staff departing. And so that arrival of, you know, the arrival of fall where I no longer needed like the apprentice work as an assistant, that person became more of like the employee.
Okay.
And that I kind of found it was, it became for a few years enough of something that I relied on that it was in 2015, a sort of, I wouldn't say horrifying moment, but a really eye-opening moment was when my staff had grown largely because my apprentices were staying on, and that had allowed the bakery this kind of sense of stability
right.
that I had never enjoyed before.
Mm-hmm.
And then one fall when a couple of apprentices had told me, oh, and the bakery was growing too. So there was like this coincidence of like apprentices wanting to stay and the bakery growing. And it was very synergistic. And then I had a couple of summertime apprentices choose not to stay. And I just felt the floor kind of falling out from underneath me. I was like, oh no, like the people who have come as apprentices and stayed in a broad categorical way are like between 28 and 32 years old. Mm-hmm. They moved to a rural, you know, backwoods New Hampshire community. They love the bakery and they want to be here for a while, but really they're not in a phase of their life where they're going to, you know, make this their career.
Right. Yeah.
And so that experience of the floor falling out from under me was like, I have one experienced baker left.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, I have two very inexperienced apprentices, neither of whom want to stick around.
Right.
And I kind of, you know, was a little bit deer in the headlights, like, oh, my model here is feeling very tenuous. And a very wise former apprentice and then coworker said to me, you know, what if rather than having people arrive and just pinning all your hopes on them staying forever, what if you just made a model where it was designed for the apprentices to come and spend a full year at the bakery, but it was really an educational opportunity that you didn't feel heartbroken and, you know, queasy every time they told you they were going to leave.
Right. Right.
And so that began kind of an investigation into how that might look. And so the spring of, or over the course of the 2016, 2017, a real educational model, I would say, mm-hmm. came forth, both through my own experience and thinking, and then some very skilled, incredibly smart, coworkers at, you know, who were here at the time. And the model that we've now arrived at, coming full to where we are now, is that we welcome a new apprentice, three new apprentices a year, but they're staggered arrival. So every 4 months, a new apprentice arrives, and we break the year into trimesters. So mm-hmm. an apprentice arrives, and for their first 4 months, they have a kind of introduction to many of the basic skills and a schedule that allows them to like be supported in the learning process of getting their feet under them in a professional kitchen, you know, having coworkers there to help guide them through the learning process. And then as they graduate onto their second trimester, there's a new apprentice arriving to take their place. And then the second trimester kind of builds on those skills that they have learned and requires the use of those skills, but also more independence and better understanding of the kinds of judgment and discretion that we bakers who have been at this for a while know and utilize on a daily basis. I often will say to apprentices, like, there are probably upwards of 1,000 discrete choices that happen, most of them unconscious, but until you've done enough of them or made enough errors, really, what a lot of it is when you don't have guidance is you just make enough errors that those discrete decisions that you're making unconsciously become conscious because you screwed something up.
Yeah.
But with guidance, right, you hopefully are going to bypass a big chunk of the, like, oops moments.
Right.
But that our expectation and the kind of support that we offer to our apprentices is that we're in an increasing way as they move through their year, both giving them what we hope is the tools to make good choices while also, I would say, the opportunity to screw things up a little bit,
right?
We want to stay on the road. We're trying not to, like, veer off the road as a group, but we need people to also, like, touch the edges enough to know that, like, none of this or very little of it is automatic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, so as they move through their second trimester, they're doing more of that independent work. And then their third trimester, we really put people in right into the heart of production in their third trimester. And they, we're 90% naturally leavened, high hydration dose. And so in their third trimester, the apprentice is the head mix person. And they come in and have to manage the mix shift all the way through the bench work, dividing and shaping those loaves. The orchestration of which on a heavy day in the summer might involve 14 or 15 mixes of between 60 and 80 kilos each, and keeping those on. We have just a single mixer for all those doughs. We have a very ancient hockey stick style diving mixer.
Yep.
And so, you know, that work is both physically demanding, mentally demanding, and requires the kinds of moment to moment judgment calls that not only make that person's job feel manageable and even exciting, or on the flip side, if mismanaged or not carried out, very much can set their day completely into disarray and everybody else's.
Yeah.
And so we take it very seriously, putting people in that position where that is their, you know, that is their role. And it, and that work is, I mean, the work of having this apprenticeship program is just infinitely fascinating and rewarding.
You're taking training seriously. You're designing a small scale educational institution too, right? And like that's what a cool way of doing it. And these folks, did they live on the farm with you guys or?
We offer housing. House, room and board and a stipend for them.
Cool. So cool.
Right here. Yeah.
And you've got permanent staff as well, right? That are in their baking.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm really curious how the staff kind of, what's the right word? They're involved in the teaching. I'm assuming they're doing the teaching. How's that received from your permanent staff? I can imagine that could be quite a empowering thing as well.
Yeah. The we're humans, and so of course every constellation of 9, 10, 12 people that find themselves in close quarters, navigating what can be very intense and tiring work, has every facet of the human experience, from, you know, the transcendent to the abysmal. And that is just the nature of it. And also, you know, can drive us all mad at times. But I think we all collectively as a group, and this is something that, you know, is at the heart of what I hope as owner and mentor to the apprentices and coworker to my full-time staff or my long-term staff. What I bring to it is that idea that I was describing earlier, that, you know, what the gift is that nothing remains stagnant here.
Mm-hmm.
We are constantly, or not constantly, but we're regularly, like at least once every 4 months, we are presented with this incredible opportunity to re-examine how we do everything.
Right.
Which I, you know, I've not worked in a lot of other bakeries, but having spent time in enough bakeries and on chat groups and stuff to see, humans are like, we very much are creatures of habit and seek sort of solidity and comfort in the, like, well, this is how it's done, and it's how we've always done it, and so that's how it's going to be. Like that trend or that instinct is pretty strong in bakers, just like it is in like carpenters and,
sure,
it is in, you know, metalsmiths and whatever. We're it's both a gift and a challenge that we are presented with new people doing, and new uniquely gifted people being put into roles that either work really, really well for them or very often don't work ideally for them. And this kind of, again, a value exchange of like, what is this? What can we learn from this new paradigm that we are offered? And what's been really hard for me, or one of the big challenges for me, is that reflexively, I usually am the one who thinks I must be doing something wrong. Like if it's not working well, yeah, I immediately think I must be doing something wrong, and I need to change things to work for everybody else.
Absolutely.
That's like that's my go-to. And what, now that like I really see this place, more and more I've been able to kind of divorce my own ego from this place and realize that like it is a, just this incredible repository of knowledge of dozens of smart, engaged, like committed people who have all sort of offered something to the place that also has involved like the letting go of their own ego.
Yeah.
And so as I have look at it more in a, not in a detached way, but in a more like, this is an organism that's like thriving on largely on its own. It's not thriving because of me, or it's not failing because of me. It's, yeah, like it has its own life. And because of that, when something isn't working great, like I don't see myself as any longer, oh, I need to solve that problem. Mm-hmm. I often say, oh, something isn't working well. Let's do the work to collectively and collaboratively arrive at a place where it works better.
Yeah. Boy,
sharing with apprentices who often arrive with a high ideals of how perfect things can work.
Yeah.
It is sometimes, you know, it is it's a narrow line to walk where you're like, yeah, and like we've been doing this for long enough that you do have good ideas.
Yeah.
And it all, you know, and this is an exchange of like, I'm not gonna hit you over the head with how your idea won't work, but I also am gonna share how deep the well is here. Yeah. This is a very deep well of honing and refining of a never perfect, but like well designed, very thoroughly thought through operation.
Sure.
And it's super exciting when we do have those moments where there's like a really great new thing that happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's also, it just takes me back to my own place. And I remember what you were describing, that feeling of, okay, it's not like something that needs changing. It's not always, on me, and I can bring let's get the team working on this. And I remember at my place once, I had to actually stop and take a step back and say, whoa, I'm inviting everyone in to talk on this. Everybody thought I was giving them hell, but it's, that's like, no, I think in the moment, isn't it cool that we get to try and fix this problem or try and make this problem better? And I actually mean it. I'm not, that's not just code for, somebody messed up. And even like the struggle, like I had, I had to rebuild my team a couple of times. And so I'm sweating, thinking of that feeling. I'm going to start January 1st and I'm down two people and I don't know how I'm going to fix this. But to reframe it, to say, I'm going to actually accept that I will always be training new people. And now let's design something so that I'm always bringing in a new person, but maybe I can, as best I can, set it up so it's going to happen three times a year by design, as opposed to me always reacting. Like that's got me tingling a little bit with possibilities just because of that shift. That's really like, that's pretty powerful.
It has been. Really been some, and I've often told people how I, in my adult life, like I've largely been land bound here,
right,
at the bakery, making this thing happen.
Yeah.
And there are so many ways that the apprenticeship program has fed this place and me personally, in that our apprentices arrive from so many different walks of life, different, parts of the country, even Costa Rica. We had an apprentice from Costa Rica. The ways that it has allowed all of us to feel connected through both geographic and, ethnic background,
yeah,
to
sure.
so much more than what we would find just here. Yeah. It's been powerful, and I have no question that it will continue to be that, because it shows no sign of losing that element.
So from a business perspective, is it set up that folks are coming to the farm to get their bread, or are you sending it out around the country, that kind of thing?
We do have a little shop here, and we've always had, we've always sold a portion of what we bake here. A significant majority is sold wholesale through farm stands and small groceries and food co-ops and CSA farms, a few restaurants, and there's a smattering of different little like delis and mom and pop stores and things like that. But our big anchors are definitely the food co-ops in the area. We have five co-ops within 35 miles of here, and those make up a majority of our wholesale. Cool. But we do serve like over 40 accounts total through all of our distribution channels.
And so how's this past year with COVID and stuff affected you in New Hampshire?
The biggest impact was our farmers markets were definitely hampered this summer. But overall, our people visiting the bakery here, especially in the early part of the spring, which tends to be our by far our slowest time of the year. Mm-hmm. We had triple the sales that we typically do in the spring. People were very enthusiastically kind of heading out to, you know, be in a not crowded place to buy their food.
Right. Yeah.
And then that died off, you know, as far as the like full pressure, like we're selling every loaf of bread that we put out by the, you know, by 11 a.m. Mm-hmm. That definitely shifted to a more traditional pattern of summertime being busy and our, you know, and then our fall foliage season was still quite busy here. And then our sales at our restaurant sales were never a large percentage, but those definitely dropped off pretty significantly. But our co-op sales are up. I think everybody, I mean, I don't have a team of market researchers figuring it out for me. But I'm just assuming that people not going out to eat as much means that people are cooking more at home and having a loaf of bread and, mm-hmm. you know, making sandwiches for their kids.
Yeah.
is a necessity. So our overall bakery growth was actually really significant this year.
Oh, good for you. Okay. Well, and did it affect your production processes and stuff much, or were you kind of able to roll with it?
We have considered all of our staff basically in the same pod. We do mask all the time, but our apprentice crew lives here and is you know, very, very low exposure. My staff that live off site are, we just had a lot of conversations about the kinds of exposures that we felt comfortable with. And honestly, until recently, the very local, infection rate and numbers have been exceedingly low.
Yeah.
More recently, there's definitely been, like everywhere else, there's been an uptick in caseload, but, those standard changes of just, you know, real vigilance around cleaning and masking all the time have been, you know, part and parcel of the year.
Good. Good. Well, good to hear. Good. You know, it's so strange as talking to people with, talking to bakers with different kinds of bakeries and different locations and stuff, and just the variety this year.
Yeah.
Although what you described, certainly in the first half of the year, of there almost being a bit of a resurgence for, you know, let's go to the small place. Let's go to the slow place. Let's buy the local thing. You know, was actually quite helpful. And I'm glad to hear that it's kind of continuing on for you, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, okay, I've got one more weird question and then I'll throw it out there. Because now were you involved with that Breadware software? Am I remembering that right, back in the back years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah. And how's that going? Is that still a thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not so so I should share a little bit just about the story really quickly.
Yeah, please.
Came about. Best I can describe it, I have a technology in general. I just have a pretty strong database and spreadsheet allergy. and so I had always heard about people, you know, doing lots of the things that I did on paper with computers. And I'd even seen some of that happen. And the second that I would sit down to like try to put a formula into Excel or something, I would just clam up and totally, you know, freeze. And none of it really, like, and I, it would just not make any sense to me. In the spring of 2011, I got so fed up because at that point I was, you know, we were doing, we had 25 or 30 accounts, and I was trying to compress 12 batches of dough and orders for 700 to like sometimes as many as 900 pieces, maybe not all loaves of bread, but like 900 pieces on like a single sheet of paper that I could like tabulate everything on, and then still using a paper and pencil and a calculator to like punch out what our total production for the day would be.
Right.
And that just, you know, it really had gotten me to a place where it felt unsustainable. And so I had met this guy who had worked in a bakery down in Durham, North Carolina. And I actually paid for him to come up and spend a few days with me, get my formulas into Excel. And I often do this where I like have grand plans about how simple it's going to be if I just have somebody sitting there with me.
Yeah.
And so he came and spent those days, and I realized at the end of it, sort of heartbroken, I was like, oh, this is not going to get simple for me.
Right.
And so I went back to the paper and pencil, and shortly thereafter, like it couldn't have been more than a month after that, I mean, I was sitting in the bakery, which, you know, is right adjacent to where we sell bread. So I'm sitting there punching out in the calculator and writing down numbers. And somebody that I recognized, but I didn't really know at the time, came in and he sort of looked over my shoulder and he's like, oh, what are you working on? And I was like, I'm just getting, you know, tomorrow's production set up. And these are my, you know, this is this grid that I have. Mm-hmm. And he said, wow, that is so much information that you figured out how to compress. It's like a, you know, it's like, it wouldn't make any sense to anybody else, but you have this like incredibly dense data, you know, it's like a compressed file on a computer that you've, you know, that somehow in your brain, you expand that out to mean so much, but it's this totally compressed file. And I was like, yeah, I guess that's true. And he said, well, you know, the work that I do is I help small businesses and nonprofit organizations work with technology to sort of liberate their people from having to hold so much information in their brains, you know, that like, yeah. He's like, I don't love technology. I don't, you know, I don't want everybody to spend all of their time, like, you know, sitting behind a screen, but I do want to give people tools to make it possible for the amount of time and energy that they devote to, things that the human brain is okay at, but computers are like by a magnitude, you know, by factors of 10 or 20 better at, mm-hmm. or actually probably more like 10,000 times better at, to have those processes done by a computer so that your brain is freed up to do other things.
Yeah.
And I was like, that sounds really, really cool. Let's talk. And, that began a 1 year process that by the wind, or not even a year, I guess it was a few months, because by like December or January of 2011 or January of 2012, we had like the basics of what was largely, and he's not a baker, mm-hmm. and I'm not a computer person. So all I did was I just told him the process that what I was trying to do. I was like, you know, I start with orders. And then from orders, I turn that into production. And then from production, I turn that into invoices. And then from invoices, I turn that into payments. And so that kind of workflow is very evident in how he designed Breadworker.
Right.
It's just like a lot of it even looks like the piece of paper that I was working on that first day that he, you know, that he came across me sitting at the table. And we absolutely still use that software. And it's funny, one of my apprentices said, this is so incredible. It has the graphic design elements of something that was like, that was like written up in the 90s, in that it's like, it does not look slick. It does not look, you know, like a state of the art piece of software. And in a lot of ways, frankly, it's not. It's not, you know, we don't have a web store through, you know, we don't do e-commerce through it. It does pretty basic tasks as far as the, as far as the software world goes, but it does it. And this is what my apprentice at the time said too. He was like, while on the front, it looks like it was written in the 90s, what it performs for the bakery is just, and he's like, I can only imagine how transformative this was for you, because, you know, it is incredibly powerful. And I couldn't agree more. That it was at this interesting pivotal moment in the bakery's history in 2011, 2012, where, you know, we were, that was right at the cusp of like when that apprentice situation was arising, where it was like, oh, I have these apprentices coming and staying on, and they're becoming this really powerful, you know, kind of stabilizing force in the bakery. And we've kind of got something stirring here. And what it, and I, you know, it, the chicken and egg kind of description of this is really where I think it lies, because I don't know if the bakery would have grown regardless of what I did, but what happened immediately after having that software and freeing my brain from like doing a lot of number crunching,
yeah,
it was just like all of a sudden I was like, oh, there's, I don't have to like cram the number of accounts that we have, the number of products we make onto like a single sheet of paper. I can like, this computer thing will like all of a sudden it'll just keep track of like thousands of data points, silently and effortlessly. And I can just make these things. And then like, lo and behold, in 2 days from when I initiate the process, somebody will be holding an invoice in a store and counting out those loaves, putting them on the store shelf. And like, I will have been involved in it, but it won't be like I was basically holding their hand the entire way.
Yeah.
And that was, that just like opened an absolute floodgate of like innovation and growth and improvement. Like, for one, just like the quality of the product got so much better, because I wasn't stuck in my, you know, in this very like rigid, narrow, compressed mental space.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Well, thanks for sharing the story, because I remember when it was first launched or first announced there through the guild, and I thought it was pretty cool. And you know, 8 years later, the conversations are still happening. Like
there are
some folk, you know,
absolutely still are. And I should say, Nathan Lysak is the guy who designed it. Yeah. He's not. He realized that like he just really doesn't want to do technical support.
Right.
And the reality is that for something like that to work well, you know, it's built on FileMaker, but like. Mm-hmm. It's its own piece of software that the platform might be universal, but like the kinks and the twists and the,
yeah,
you know, and the support required to get it up and running is too great.
Yeah. So. Which is like totally the dilemma for the smaller bakers, right? You know, cause the bigger guys can afford the larger software that has the support, and the smaller guys can't. And so they end up saying, well, I guess I have to pretend my business is a CSA or a farm stand or something, just because there's software for that. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
For sure.
Public together.
Cool. Well, hey, like I could talk to you for about a month, but I want to be respectful of your time here, but I'm curious, is there anything that we should have been talking about before I got you sidetracked on software?
No, I really enjoyed the conversation. I do have a very early morning tomorrow to get in and be at the baking again. So
totally.
I'm sure as I'm laying down to go to sleep, I'll be like, oh man, I wish I had shared the thing about and that and this and that. That is the nature of conversation. There's always a new avenue that could be explored.
Right on.
But for tonight, I'm really pleased that we had a chance to talk, and
for sure.
And I think, you know, we'll come back around to it another time.
Yeah, you betcha. That's what March and April are for. We'll reach back out. You make a list and I'll make a list and we'll get back together. But no, thanks so much, Noah, for taking the time, for having the chat, for every message of yours that I've read over the years on the different chat forums and that kind of thing. I was thinking back to, you know, I guess 2010, 2008, when I joined the guild and stuff, and the early days and building my bakery and stuff, and all the cries for help that I put out in the world. And you were one of the guys that I was like, I was always absorbing everything that you were sharing with me and everything that you were sharing with other people. And I really do appreciate it. And I can't believe it's been this long before I finally reached out to talk to you. So I'm so grateful for the time and thanks for having the chat.
I'm not a strong believer in name dropping at all, but I want to just say that, you know, that voice that you heard me, bringing to the conversation on the guild website is very much because in 2001 and 2002, when I was reaching out to Alan Scott and Dan Wing and Richard Miskovich and Cyril Hitz and Jeffrey Hamelman and others that I'm, Jen Lapidus, so many other bakers who, while we weren't connecting necessarily through the bread bakers chat group,
right,
there was always a person on the other end of the line, whether it be email or a phone, who was like, sure, I want to help. I have information and I want to, contribute to your learning. And that, I don't think that necessarily bakers are unique in that way, but I think bakers are uniquely generous. My experience.
100%. That in a nutshell is the whole reason for this podcast, is because that's what I experienced in my time through that journey. And I just, it's like, I just want to share that with other folks too. And I hear you. It's out of Jeffrey's book. I think it's the epilogue again, where he talks about, standing on the shoulders of those who came before. And that's, Lord knows that's what I did. And that's what he did. And that's what the next round is doing. And that's awesome. So yeah, good way to end this. So thanks so much. And I really do appreciate the time for sure.
Absolutely. We'll talk again soon.
So that was Noah. Cool, hey? What a great guy. Maybe the reason I waited so long to talk to him is because I knew in my heart that we would have a chat like this. And I didn't have the guts to have it earlier. Put it that way. Maybe I was just too nervous, but Noah's such a thoughtful guy and really thinks deeply about what he's doing and the business he's building and then puts that into action. And I just love learning from him. I really do. And so thanks for listening to this. I hope you got something from it as well. I hope you got several ideas out of this and, maybe something that you can take action on in your own bakery. That'd be fun. If you want to keep the conversation going, if you want to keep talking about topics like this, why don't you head over to bakersforbakers.org? That's the free online community that I started sort of tied in with the show, sort of parallel to the show, where we can talk about the business of baking in more depth through the forum. We've got a couple hundred members right now and some very active ones that are bakers from all over the world, literally all over the world, and also at all levels of baking, from, you know, micro bakers that are just starting out in their own homes to, you know, retired bakery owners and bakery instructors, you know, that kind of thing, like the whole realm and all parts in between. It's a very generous group because bakers are generous people. So don't be shy. Head over there, bakersforbakers.org, and sign up. I hope you liked the chat today. I really enjoyed having it with Noah. I enjoy talking with you, and I'm going to do it again next week. So until then, have a great week. Stay safe. Stay healthy. Bake lots. Happy baking. Bye-bye.